growing up with a very internal world that was separate to the external world that I looked at, not feeling very connected to a lot of people. And then being able to be creative on stage let me shape the external world to look like my internal world and make connections between those two, which was quite powerful for a little shy kid.
Welcome to How to Play in Slow Time, interviews on creativity, where artists pull back the curtain on their creative practices and share how they listen, play, embody, imagine, model, and collaborate towards discovering something new. In this episode, performer and musician Pablo Latona tells us about growing up in a household that encouraged free imaginative play and how this allowed them to connect with others as a shy child. They explain that this accidental training in play informs their work today as a designer of participatory installations and as a clown doctor in hospitals. This was the first episode for the series that we recorded, and unfortunately we faced some technical issues. That means the recording isn't as clear as we'd like it to be, but it's such a great interview from Pablo, we really wanted to share it with you. Pablo and I actually ended up sitting inside a cupboard in my parents' apartment for this recording, which you might enjoy imagining as you listen. Okay, that's enough from me. Here's Pablo.
My name is Pablo Latona. I sign off my emails calling myself a fun smith. That feels like the best description, but it maybe doesn't describe everything. I make participatory and placemaking art, usually in a performative context. And I also work as a clown doctor in pediatric wards. I was given space to explore free imaginative play a lot as a kid. We had a piano in the house. My mum was a little bit of a hippie and not super like keen on formalized piano lessons. She thought they would like beat the creativity out of me. And at the time I thought that was silly, but in hindsight maybe it set me up really well because she found someone to teach me improvisation. So this person would just kind of jam with me on the piano. That developed my sense of free play and not, I guess, being less creatively restricted, or like not worrying too much about rules of creativity and discovering and making those rules for myself. I've gone through spells of doing a composition work for theatre and circus and dance productions. But at the moment, music is mainly just for myself. It's like the art that I do without worrying about an audience. We use the word play when we're talking about music. We say you play music, but it's easy to forget that music is a form of play, even though it's baked into the way we talk about it. So jamming can just feel like an impro game rather than creative exercise where you're trying to find excellence. And that's when it feels really fun for me. Probably music was my main creative joy as a kid for a long time. And then that only really shifted when I was 14 and my grandparents gave me a book called Juggling for the Complete Klutz. So I learned how to juggle and then I joined the local youth circus. And that developed an appreciation for stage performing. That was a very formative part of how I ended up having a creative profession. Being a quite insular kid, you end up with, you know, strong imagination powers, or powers of, yeah, imaginative or creative play. And then being able to take those things that you see in your head and make them into reality so that other people can see them viscerally as well, and sharing them and maybe co-create them is a very connective experience. I guess the short summary of the story between being a teen circus performer and today is that I did a lot of stage performing and then shifted from that when I found that relationship with audiences to be not particularly enjoyable in terms of getting a lot of most of my validation from thousands of anonymous strangers clapping for me. That was not satisfying and was a weird way to exist as a human and an ego. And so then I shifted to making more participatory art, where I was engaging directly with people, and which is essentially just making experience gifts for people, right? Like a kid would make an experience gift for their parents for Father's Day or whatever. And so making experience gifts for people where they get to enjoy being connected with each other and with their space. Government bodies like to call it placemaking art. I like to call it place-affirming art, because a place is already a place. And particularly being a white person in a colonized country, placemaking sounds pretty gross. I realized I was making experience gifts for other people, but not getting to have that experience myself. And so I started trying to find ways for me to be a part of that as well. We live in, or at least I do, live in a community or culture where it's mainly through our dogs that we connect to strangers, right? like it's socially okay to say hello to someone and have a little stranger chat if one or both of you is walking a dog, but outside of that you can't. And so, yeah, I'm always looking for creative ways to replace the dog. Yeah, I guess this is one of my other processes, is just making a thing that I want. so sometimes if I'm like at a big festival, there's a lot going on, the noise and all the different kinds of stimulation there are energizing, and then after a while you just want a little break from all of the overstimulation. This is in response to a brief or a commission from the National Botanic Gardens. And the work called Hear This. It was a thing that I had been thinking about versions of this work for a long time. They were looking for an interactive work within a festival where people were walking around the botanic gardens and discovering little hidden unexpected things to engage with. So what I pitched was this, a listening experience. You're walking around and you discover a place where there are four different seats or beds, each with a pair of headphones, and a performer standing there, me, inviting you to be part of the experience and put these headphones on. People don't know what they're gonna hear. They stick the headphones on, they hear some kind of dreamy, ethereal sounds. And then maybe after a minute or so, they might realize that what they're listening to is just all of the environmental sounds that are going on with effects like lush reverbs and whatnot added on. I did some audio design to make a like 12-minute audio piece that is only made up of automated sound effects. So if you put the headphones on and there's no external noise, then you hear nothing, but in a noisy environment, a festival, distant music and people chatting and whatnot, the incoming audio is getting processed by effects that change over time. So there will be reverbs that get more and more lush and then suddenly disappear, or there'll be little moments where it samples or records what's going on and then plays it back half a minute later, or plays with the timbre of what's coming in. So you get variation, but with the general theme of taking the incoming audio and making it more dreamlike, more airy and more expansive in a way that I think feels a little bit like emulating that drifting off half asleep, low stimulation experience that I was talking about. People discover this. After a minute or so of listening in the headphones, they discover that they're just listening to the live audio. And then either people then just like lie down and take it in and close their eyes, or a lot of the time people then realize that they can add to the audio for themselves and for the other listeners. So you'll have this great visual for passers-by. They'll be passing by and they'll see four people lying down, couple of them just drifting off, and a couple of them just going, "Hey, hey, whoa, hey, hey, ha, hey, ha, oh." And those people are making those sounds so that they can hear them through the lush reverb and everything. And so then they're playing with the installation, and then people walking past are going, what the heck's going on there? Why are they doing that? And then they'll come and line up and join the experience. The more I work with one particular form, the more I end up just doing a lot of thinking and just writing down ideas on paper, and then like pretty close to the last minute actually turning it into a thing. Because when I'm very familiar with the form, then I have a pretty high hit rate to sketching it out in my mind and then making it real, and what I make ends up looking and working pretty much exactly as I imagined in my head, which is both a good and a bad thing. It means that I can have an idea and have a confidence that it will work and look how I think it will, but it also means that sometimes I miss out on that injection of random elements that comes from being more hands-on. With the balloon piano, I just happened to have, for a different project, I had some like MIDI audio trigger doodads where you can stick a little trigger on any object, and then hitting that object sends audio trigger signals into your computer so you can play a sound. So I had this device for another project. That was quite a complicated project, and then I was looking for simpler ways to use this tech. I think I just got invited to do something at my friend's very low-key album launch in a community hall. I thought, oh yeah, I'll just like join in with one of your songs by playing the melody on helium balloons. So yeah, with the balloon piano, it's like discovering how quickly you can run from this end to the other end to be able to hit the high note. And so that's a fun part of the creative process. But then also, if people get to see you at that limit and having to run and almost but not quite make it or make it, then that's lovely as well, because they're not just watching a polished product, they're watching you be a human. Our job as clown doctors in pediatric ward is to listen to and empower the people in that medical ward using imaginative play. It's a very like careful form of play. It's a version of play that is not just demonstrating playfulness, but inviting playfulness. That's an integral part of the work we do. So that's using play to co-create imaginative worlds or imaginative play with other people, in a way, uses play to empower. And so I guess I'm not there in the pediatric ward trying to just entertain people and make them laugh, but to create imaginative worlds and playful experiences together in a way that helps to process the reality of what's going on, provide an alternate, maybe imaginative reality that helps a child exist playfully in a difficult place, and puncture tension in a place where there's a lot of tension. In doing this work, doing medical clown work, it has become increasingly apparent that play is often most important in places where it seems the least likely or the least appropriate.
This episode is part of a series of interviews with extraordinary people talking about their creative practice. You can find the rest of the series wherever you get your podcasts. You can also purchase our book titled How to Play in Slow Time, which unpacks the theory, practice, and teaching approaches to creativity from Brill Publishers at brill.com. How to Play in Slow Time was created and produced by Charlotte Barrell, Alexandra Telamo, Brioni Trezise, and Maria White. Edited and scored with original music by Tom Hogan. Special thanks goes out to the Technical Resource Centre and the Creative Practice Lab at UNSW Sydney, where our podcast was recorded. UNSW Sydney exists on the lands and waters that have been cared for since time immemorial by the Bidjigal people of the Eora Nation, whose sovereignty has never ceded. I'm Alex Telmo, and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of How to Play in Slow Time, interviews on creativity.